This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about fascism in the United States.
There's a whiff of fascism about Donald Trump, but is there really a danger of fascism now? Our guest, Paul LeBlanc, talks about fascism, what it is, and how to fight it.
We'll examine President Obama's recent visit to Cuba and talk about U.S.-Cuba relations.
Could this be the beginning of a beautiful relationship? We talk more with Walter Lippmann of Cuban News about what's happened and where things might go.
And we have a special visit with Eli Smith, who dropped by our studios to talk about the upcoming Brooklyn Folk Festival.
Brooklyn has become the center for the folk music revival in the United States, and the festival, now in its eighth year, is going to be spectacular. BrooklynFolkFest.com. Get the information and come to the festival.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
There's been much discussion in liberal and left circles about whether Donald Trump is a fascist and whether the country is in danger of becoming fascist. It is pointed out that Trump is a demagogue, a liar. He's for violence. He's a racist against Muslims and Mexicans and a misogynist. He's for bringing back torture and for increasing American government aggression in Syria. Today, we talk with Professor Paul LeBlanc, who teaches history at La Roche University in Pittsburgh. We speak with Professor LeBlanc about what fascism is and how to fight it. Professor LeBlanc is the author of a number of books on European revolutionaries, including Trotsky, Lenin, and Rosa Luxemburg. With respect to America, he wrote A Short History of the U.S. Working Class, and he co-authored with economist Michael Yates the highly acclaimed Freedom Budget for All Americans, recapturing the promise of the civil rights movement in the struggle for economic justice. Professor Paul LeBlanc, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Paul, I wanted to start off by asking you, what is fascism? And do you think that it's the case, as some commentators, liberals and leftists alike, are starting to say, that Donald Trump represents a particular American form of fascism?
Yeah, I think those are both very important questions. I want to start with the second question that you raised, and then go to the first, and then swing back to the second. This is extremely important. The term fascism has been used a lot as a pejorative term to describe things that are horrible that we don't like. But I think that we need to try to understand the actual history in order to see where we are now with the Trump phenomenon. You know, one thing that is significant to me is Mussolini, who established fascism in Italy, and Hitler, who established the German form of fascism, Nazism. When they took power, they were in their early to mid-40s. If Trump wins the election, he'll be 70. These guys had their own political organizations and social movements that they had been systematically developing for 5 to 10 years before taking power. And Trump doesn't have that. That's not what he's about. It's more like reality TV with image and mood and personality and hype, but not the kind of movement and doctrines that developed doctrines that the earlier fascists had developed. There's another important difference, and I imagine we'll return to this later in the discussion, and that is a primary piece of the equation, both in Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, was the existence of a powerful labor movement and a massive left-wing movement, socialist and communist parties that were very substantial, and that were capable of challenging and, if they chose to go down that path, to overturn capitalism in the foreseeable future. And there's nothing like that today in the United States. The Bernie Sanders campaign is important, but again, that doesn't represent the kind of left-wing, you know, substantial left-wing labor movement that had existed before. If you take a look at what fascism actually was, there were these, both in both countries, Italy and Germany, there were mass nationalist movements that intended to restore their respective countries in various ways. Both Italy and Germany had sustained serious damage through war and economic instability and depression. They were fueled by a right-wing populism and paramilitary groups. They had a developed ideology that was anti-liberal and anti-socialist. They were determined to preserve capitalism, a form of capitalism that would be regulated by the government and that would be tied in with militarism and expansionism. They were ultra-nationalist, xenophobic, racist, and established authoritarian governments headed by strongmen. With Trump, it seems to me, and the Trump phenomenon, there are seeds of this, but it is not a fully developed phenomenon as has existed under Mussolini or Hitler. Trump is egocentric, he's a bigot, he's a hustler, he's a demagogue, he's a bully, but he's not the leader of the kind of fascist movements that took power in Italy and Germany.
One of the aspects of the Trump phenomena, which I think is so alarming to all of us, is his simultaneous advocacy of violence and at the same time denying that he's for violence. I'm reminded of a heroic, brilliant German lawyer back in the 30s who represented the labor movement in Germany, represented a lot of workers and represented victims of Hitler's stormtroopers. And he was representing several workers at a trial, and he called Adolf Hitler to the stand, and he cross-examined Hitler for 3 hours. And Hitler had always denied that he was for violence, but at the same time, he would encourage the stormtroopers to beat up socialists and unionists and leftists. And after 3 hours of being lacerated by Hans Littner, Hitler was exposed for what he was. You know, I wish that someone would have the chance to do that to Trump. But in any case, Littner, after the Reichstag fire, which you'll talk to us about presently, but after the Reichstag fire in 1933, Littner was picked up, imprisoned, sent to various concentration camps, tortured, and after a five-year period in 1938, he committed suicide. And now there's a memorial statue to Littner. He's extremely well-known and celebrated in Germany. And in fact, our own Michael Ratner several years ago was presented by the bar in Germany with the Hans Littner Award. So I just wanted to recall a famous anti-fascist lawyer, which I thought was appropriate for a show called Law and Disorder.
Mm-hmm.
But to get back to our discussion, Paul, what do you think explains the Trump phenomena? Could that result in an American fascism?
Yeah, I think that's an important question. As I said before, I think that while Trump and his campaign don't represent a full-blown fascism, there are seeds of that that we can find in the campaign, in the rhetoric, in the actions of Trump. And just as in Italy and Germany, there is a tremendous instability. Actually, if we take a look at our economic system and the way that it's functioned over the decades and the way it has functioned since it became dominant in the global economy, we find that there is ongoing innovation, ongoing change, growing instability, growing inequality. Some people becoming very, very rich, many other people finding their way of life shattered by new developments, periodic crises, you know, tremendous upturns and then tremendous downturns. So that's been part of the scene for a very long time. There are some folks in the working class in Germany, in Italy, in Europe, and in other countries and continents who argued what we need is an economic democracy, that the working people should take control of the economy and use it to meet the needs of everybody. This was the ideal of Karl Marx and socialists and communists who were inspired by those ideas. And so there were very powerful movements going in that direction. And at the same time, there were many people who heard and found different explanations that were racist, that were irrational, that were nationalistic, that represented something else again, something far to the right. And there were some people who were drawn to that. And then there were the rich and the powerful who wanted to maintain their system. And what we find both in Italy and in Germany is those who had wealth and power at a certain point aligned themselves, made deals, formed coalitions with people like Mussolini and Hitler in order to smash the labor movement, in order to stop the left. As I said before, that's an important part of the equation if we want to understand the rise of fascism. Another important reality is that neither Hitler nor Mussolini won a majority of the Italian people or the German people initially. They were drawn into power by the wealthy and powerful classes that dominated those societies. And it seems to me at this point, at least, there were many powerful people, major corporate executives. There are some who are supporting Trump. But there are many who don't want to go in that direction yet. They don't feel that there's enough of a threat. But there are large numbers of people who are being hurt by what's been happening in our society over the past 20 years, with the rich making super profits and middle-income people finding that their standard of living is being pushed down, and the American dream seems to be evaporating. People are looking for solutions to that problem. And the mainstream of the Republican Party and the mainstream of the Democratic Party have not been providing solutions. They've been providing more of the same. So many people are feeling desperate and looking for solutions, and to the extent that there's not a strong democratic solution provided by the left, there are people who are, like Trump, who are providing more authoritarian, ultra-nationalistic, and racist so-called solutions. And I think that's part of the dynamic that's taking place. I think that potentially some of the people who are drawn to what Trump is talking about could be drawn to something much better, but that something much better has to be presented as part of our politics, and the mainstream politicians of both parties have no interest in that economic democracy that we need.
So would you say that fascism is just another form of class rule? I mean, could you have capitalism with a monarchy, or could you have capitalism with a liberal democracy, and then also have capitalism with a fascist dictatorship?
You have had, in Italy and Germany, you had capitalism with a fascist dictatorship, no doubt about it. In both countries, before fascism took power, you had what you're calling liberal democracy, which is sort of a fake democracy. That is, people had the right to vote, but the economy and the major decisions were controlled by the wealthy and privileged few. And then there were problems with a growing left wing, but then those who had power and wealth decided to support that growing right wing of people who were looking for a way out of the crisis. In a number of countries still, some monarchies and some that have a significant amount of power, like in Saudi Arabia, for example, that have basically a capitalist economy. If one was going to have a full, thoroughgoing rule by the people politically, it seems to me that would also translate into rule by the people over the economy, which would mean challenging and capitalism and replacing it with socialism. But I think as long as capitalism exists and the instabilities, the dynamism, the problems of capitalism exist, there'll always be a potential for authoritarian political solutions, you know, including fascism.
What was the class base for fascism in Germany and Italy?
Well, in both countries, you had small property owners, small farmers, small business people. You had white-collar workers who didn't identify themselves as part of the working class, wanted to see themselves as some kind of new middle class, you know, better than the working class, who, because of the dynamism and instability and problems being generated by capitalism, felt that they were being pushed down, that they were losing or in danger of losing the few things that they had and the little property that they had. And then there were some other sections of the working class that, for one reason or another, were not part of the labor movement, not part of the organized working class movement that was so strong both in Italy and Germany, and had been lured into a support of, you know, nationalist and authoritarian and racist solutions to the problems. They were looking for some kind of strongman, some kind of boss who would establish order and stability and prosperity somehow. And then there were wealthy people and you know, very rich business people and landowners who were afraid of the potential of revolutionary, you know, socialist, anti-capitalist movements and developments, who wanted to use the fascist movements as a battering ram to smash the left and to maintain their own power and privilege. So it was a mixed thing. Both Mussolini and Hitler said, you know, we're above classes, we're beyond classes, we want an alliance of all these different important social forces, patriotic businessmen and patriotic farmers and patriotic workers to build the country and so forth and make it strong. It was that kind of a development. I think when you really dig down, this was not the first choice of a majority of the capitalists, just as Trump, I don't think, is the first choice of a large number of capitalists in the United States, business people in the United States. But in both cases, because they represented very broad, dynamic movements, large numbers of you know, middle and lower income people were drawn to the fascist movement. You know, business folks decided to, and landowners decided to go with that, to play with that, to in order to use it and control it. And I think that something like that could develop in the United States, but we're not there yet. But we can see the seeds of it in what we're calling the Trump phenomenon.
So do you think that there's a germ of fascism endemic to capitalism? I mean, why wasn't fascism defeated in World War II?
Well, it was, but I think the problem is that the same kinds of problems that gave rise to fascism have continued, and therefore, you know, it's capable of arising again, and the seeds of it are developing, you know, in various countries, and in some cases not just the seeds are developing. For example, in Greece, you've got a full-blown fascist movement. You know, in other countries too, there are movements like that developing. In the United States, we're not quite there yet, but I think coming out of the Trump campaign, it's conceivable that some of the folks who are drawn to Trump will begin to develop, you know, those kinds of organizations and doctrines and movements.
You know, what's so curious about Trump is that in Germany, the church was elevated. What was the slogan? Kinder, Kirsch, and the other one, Kitchen. The nuclear family was elevated. Children, women staying at home, and here you've got Donald Trump, who's been married three times, so, you know, sort of disreputable in his business dealings. He's not particularly a religious man, it seems. In that respect, he's totally different from the kind of sentimentality about the church and the family and women that was so elevated in Germany.
Yes, although if you take a look at the actual lives of Hitler and Mussolini, these were not pious, church-going, family-centered men. So there's a significant amount of demagoguery and hustling that we can find in them also. So Trump is prepared to be all things to, well, not all things to all people, but he's prepared to, appeal to evangelicals, although there are many evangelical leaders who are horrified by the kind of person he actually is. I don't think that Trump is going to be the American Mussolini. I don't think he has enough years left in him, and I don't think things are advanced that way. But I think that the kinds of dynamics that we're discussing, the kinds of seeds that resulted in fascism, they're not absent from our own political reality. One of the reasons that people have turned to Trump is they don't see solutions in mainstream politics. And if we fail to develop a left wing, genuinely democratic, genuinely humanistic alternative to the present system, to the status quo, if we're not offering people something to the left, then many desperate people are going to look for solutions wherever they think they see them, and that will be to the right, with demagogues like Trump and demagogues who are younger and more dynamic and more organized than Trump. Maybe not as rich as Trump, but we have a big job to do if we want to eliminate that danger. We've got to build our own social movements and our own social struggles that are not going to be hobbled by so-called mainstream politics that accepts the instabilities and inequalities of the present system.
We're speaking with historian Professor Paul LeBlanc on the topic of fascism. We're getting into really the second half of our discussion, which is what is fascism, but now we're talking about and how to fight it. And Paul, let me ask you this. Do you think that we can build the kind of organization that you just sketched out using the vehicle of the Democratic Party?
No, I don't think that's possible. First of all, I would argue that we've got to build on a much more fundamental level than simply elections and electoral politics. We've got to build in our communities, in our workplaces, and throughout society, movements, organizations, and struggles that will fight for human rights of all people, for liberty and justice for all, for a decent life and equal rights for everybody, and social and economic justice. And we've got to build those struggles and build a consciousness around not only the importance of those struggles, but the importance of solutions, solutions that will involve economic democracy, or what I think you and I would call socialism. That's what we mean by socialism, economic democracy.
Well, we both contributed chapters to the book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. So, yes, indeed, that's what we would call socialism.
Right. And so then I would think that as we build that kind of those kinds of movements and struggles and consciousness, that will be reflected in electoral activity, and we'll want to build campaigns that that will be going in that direction and trying to establish control by the people, power of the people politically and then also economically. The problem with the Democratic Party is that it is devoted, as Hillary Clinton has emphasized more than once, to the capitalist system, and socialists who are sincere but drawn into Democratic Party politics will necessarily have to compromise with those who control the purse strings and those who control the central institutions of the party. And that means that the struggle for economic democracy will be fundamentally compromised. The Democratic Party will not be a vehicle for bringing about the changes that we need. So we need a very different kind of politics. Bernie Sanders, although he's running in the Democratic Party, has correctly emphasized we need a political revolution. Politics as usual in the two major parties In my opinion, anyone who's sincere about socialism will find that's a dead end. We've got to build our own party.
How are you going to feel? And I know that a lot of what Bernie Sanders has been saying is extremely appealing and worthy of support. But he's also said that if he doesn't get the nomination, he's going to ask his supporters to support Hillary Clinton. And my concern is that the Democratic Party could be a graveyard for the social movement that Bernie Sanders both reflects and has helped organize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with what you're saying, Michael. I think that Sanders is sincere when he's talking about a political revolution. I think that Hillary Clinton, for if not all of her life, at least all of her political life, so far back as I can remember, has represented political counter-revolution, working with the big business corporations, the multinational corporations, to advance their interests, which are not the same as our interests. To the extent that we support Hillary Clinton, I think we bring discredit to ourselves. If we say this is the way to advance towards a political revolution, then there are large numbers of people who will not take us seriously and be disappointed if we win, just as people were disappointed with Obama. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of hope that he would actually do things that he said, you know, some of the good things that he said. But he is part of a totally compromised political party. As long as we support the Hillary Clintons and, you know, other so-called liberal Democrats, we're going to be tied into a growing problem. We won't be building the solution. Although I have much sympathy for things that Sanders is talking about and putting forward and so on, I think it's a mistake for him to, you know, to say that he'll be supporting Hillary Clinton. That will leave us open to more terrible developments down the road if we're not building a strong democratic, small d democratic, left-wing alternative to the status quo.
Well, we've come to the end of our allotted time, Professor Paul LeBlanc. I want to thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and look forward to having you on again. Good luck.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure, that would be great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The revolution of 1959 was not just a political revolution, it was a social revolution. The 99% took over the resources of their own country, and 1% fled to Miami. In response, the United States began its blockade of Cuba in 1960. A memo written by a senior State Department official laid out American policy, advocating for, quote, a line of action that makes the greatest inroads into denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of the Castro government. Last year, the United States reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba. And in his historic visit last week, President Obama said in Havana, quote, I affirm that Cuba's destiny will not be decided by the United States or any other nation. We talk about the U.S. relations with Cuba today and President Obama's recent visit with Walter Lippmann, editor of the Cuba News Yahoo News Group. Welcome, Walter, to Law and Disorder.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me.
Walter, I know that you've been a longtime supporter of the Cuban Revolution, sometimes critically, but nevertheless someone who's been engaged with and supporting and defending the Cuban Revolution. And we're so happy to have you on Law and Disorder to get your take on the Obama visit of last week. So tell me, what was your reaction when Air Force One landed in Havana?
I was absolutely thrilled to pieces. I watched it, and I was delighted. Because think about this. Until less than 1 year ago, President Obama was the commander-in-chief and president of a government which had declared Cuba to be a state sponsor of terrorism. And before he even went into the airport, he accepted flowers from a representative of a state sponsor of terrorism, as his government had defined it, less than 1 year ago. That image, to me, was extraordinarily revealing. You know, most people don't read very much, and as we all know, memories are very short. And I think the image of Barack Obama and his family accepting flowers from the Cuban government was extremely significant and proud, and I was thrilled to be able to see it. In a sense, that image canceled out, at least for a moment or so, 50 years of vilification of Cuba in the American media. By the way, the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times, they spent their whole coverage of the trip on negative stuff, on the dissidents, as if the dissidents represented anything. They represent almost nothing.
Yes, no, I know. I know. And a lot of them, from what I've read, at least in the past, are people that are taking both money and direction from counter-revolutionaries in Miami and also from the what had been the American Interest section. But let me ask you this, because I want to talk about what it was that caused this dramatic 180-degree turn signified by Obama's landing in the airport. The U.S. embargo of Cuba, which is partially still in place, as we know, and we'll talk about that, was initiated by President Eisenhower during the Cold War in response to the 1960 memo that was written by a senior State Department official. And the memo proposed the following, quote, a line of action that makes the greatest inroads in denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of the Castro government. And that line of action had been employed against Cuba up until very recently. And in fact, there still is a law in the books, the Helms-Burton law, that calls for the American government to aid in what they call the transition in Cuba. I wanted to ask you, what were the factors that came about that caused this reversal of policy?
Well, the main factor that caused it is, as Obama himself stated, that those policies and those tactics did not succeed in achieving their objective. They did not succeed. They did and do make life hard for the Cuban people, definitely. They deny funds and they deny investment in Cuba that Cuba wants, but at the same time, they've not succeeded in overthrowing the Cuban system. That's what the previous tactics were designed to do, and they failed. And that is why Obama changed. I mean, if you think about the speech that Obama made in Miami when he was a candidate for president a couple of years ago, it's extraordinary the transformation. He said in Miami, throughout my entire life, there has never been justice. There has been injustice in Cuba. Never in my lifetime have the people of Cuba known freedom. Never in the lives of two generations of Cuban have the people of Cuba known democracy. This is the terrible and tragic status quo that we have known for half a century. Now, he didn't say that yesterday when he spoke to the Cuban people, did he?
No. In fact, what he did say, Walter, and I'd like your reaction to this, he said, I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. And then he went on to say, I want you to know, I believe my visit here demonstrates that you do not need to fear a threat from the United States. So, Walter Lippmann, do you believe that American policy is still aiming to restore capitalism to Cuba?
Well, the Helms-Burton Law, the Torricelli Law, and the Cuban Adjustment Act remain on the books and in force. In fact, I was kind of surprised that people like Ileana Ross-Layton didn't go to court to try to charge Obama with violation of the Helms-Burton Law, which is, after all, the law of the land. And Obama lectured, they like to lecture Cuba about the rule of law. Well, he's in violation of the Helms-Burton Law, which says they won't recognize any government with a Castro in it.
I know.
So he's in violation of Helms-Burton Law. Of course, I'm delighted that he violated the law, and I don't think he should be prosecuted. But think about that. He's the commander-in-chief of a government whose declared official foreign policy is the overthrow of the Cuban government. And not only that, he is the commander-in-chief and the president of a country which does something that's completely unique on the entire planet Earth. The United States occupies national territory of Cuba while publicly declaring its policy of overthrowing its government, and it's the only country in the entire world where the United States has a military base in a country whose government they declare they're going to overthrow.
Speaking of that, what do you think the future is of America's possession of Guantanamo?
Well, I'm 72 years old, and my crystal ball isn't quite what it was when I was 20 and 30. The Cubans don't want it there. They don't cash the rent checks that the United States dutifully gives them. They don't want it there. But the Cubans, they're in no position militarily or in any other way to get the thing out. So they have to wait until the United States is ready to leave. They can't remove it. They're against it. They demand its removal, but they can't physically kick it out.
Walter, the U.S. press has made a big deal about Cuba's alleged lack of human rights, despite their record on education, health care, and other things that we don't measure up to. Can you give a brief comparison of how human rights in that island nation measure up to our human rights in the U.S.?
Well, we have to begin to know if we're going to communicate with someone, we have to speak to them in a language that they can understand. And the basic problem really is here that the United States government and the Cubans have two completely different conceptions of human rights. In Cuba, human rights include the right to medical care and education completely free from the cradle to the grave. In the United States, the only real freedom that we recognize is the right to own private property and the right to stand on a street corner and make a public demonstration, a public protest against the government. You can own a newspaper, but if nobody will read it, who cares? So the big problem is definitional. Cubans have one definition and the United States has another. When Obama goes to Cuba and speaks to them about the right to protest and freedom of the press, he didn't do that. He doesn't do that in Saudi Arabia, does he? He doesn't do that in Gaza.
True.
The New York Times.
He doesn't do that in the Gulf Emirates.
No, it's totally opportunistic. I understand that.
And you know, he goes to China. He doesn't tell the Chinese that. Mm. He only tells the Cubans that. Mm.
Yeah. No, it's a cudgel. The Times, the first day that Obama got there, said that he landed in the airport and that he faced the challenges inherent in normalizing relations with a communist police state. And that kind of description defies what I know and what you and Heidi know about what happens in Cuba. Talk about that, for example. Are there elections in Cuba? Who votes? What does the government represent? I think American people are just ignorant. Mm. They think that Fidel handed over power to his brother, and it's a one-person dictatorial setup.
Well, Fidel didn't exactly hand over power to his brother. His brother was the first vice president. So, and in a normal order of succession, when one person leaves, the person who's in line by the Cuban Constitution takes over, and that's what happened. And Fidel sits there, and he's not complaining. He knows how to read and write, and he knows what's going on. He's not complaining.
But he knows
he's not in a position to run the government anymore, and he's not.
But there are national elections.
As far as elections, of course, they have elections. They regularly have elections in Cuba, but their electoral system is completely different. Completely different from the one we have here. Here we have an electoral system in which money is the primary thing that goes on. They're spending tens of millions of dollars to try to select candidates before they even get to the election here in this country. In this country, in Cuba, the only money that they spend is to print little 8.5 by 11 sheets with the names of the candidates. And they put them up in local store windows where people vote. There is no campaigning in Cuba.
And wonderfully, there's no advertising there as well. Can you talk briefly about their infant mortality, life expectancy, and literacy rates? I think they surpass us in those fields.
I don't have figures in front of me about these things, but Cuba's statistics and all those things are very high. They're among the highest in the world. I don't know if they exceed the United States. They might, but I don't know that. I don't have the figures in front of me.
Well, I have them in front of me, and in fact, in some respects, they do. I think women live longer in the United States, but men live longer in Cuba. Infant mortality rate is about the same. Education, I think, is probably better in Cuba because you can go through college guaranteed, even through medical school. And there are more doctors in Cuba per person than any other place. In those respects, Cuba, despite being, and people should understand that Cuba was a very poor island nation back in 1959 when the revolution happened. Your average Cuban lived out on the land in a grass hut, was illiterate, was disease-ridden, didn't have shoes, worked seasonably. Bad-off place, like Haiti's a bad-off place. And in the years since 1959, things have changed dramatically. And I think that the American people don't get a chance to understand that.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they've kept a travel ban on Americans, on people from the United States going to Cuba for all these years. They don't want people to see that. And I mean, there are plenty of people in Cuba that speak English and that could tell them. You know, here in the United States, when somebody goes to med school and graduates, now unless they're completely brilliant and have a scholarship, they graduate med school owing $100,000, $200,000 or more thousands of dollars. In Cuba, when you graduate from med school, you owe nothing, absolutely nothing. Now you do have an obligation once you complete that medical school to go wherever the Cuban government wants to send you. If they want to send you to a rural area, that's where you got to go. If they want to send you to Pakistan, you got to go. But people volunteer for those things. They like those jobs. They also get a little bit of extra money when they go there, and they get to bring things back to Cuba when they travel abroad. But they have no debt whatsoever except their debt to the society that gave them that medical education that they have to use that medical education for its basic purpose, which is health care, not making money.
Walter, can you tell our listeners briefly what has been done already and what more President Obama can do vis-a-vis travel and trade with Cuba?
Well, I think the first thing he could do is simply allow everyone in the United States who wants to go to Cuba for whatever reason to go to Cuba for whatever reason. You know, it's illegal to go to Cuba and be a tourist, just to go there and go to the beach and Have fun. That's a criminal offense, and Cuba's the only country in the world where that remains the case.
Right. One can't spend money down there. That's actually the offense.
That's beginning to change now.
Right.
And, you know, they are, PayPal is down there, Western Union is down there and expanding, and all these other money-sending services are down there. So that's all beginning to change. You can't spend paper U.S. dollars, but actually, you know, the Cubans announced last week that they were planning to remove the 10% surcharge that they charge when you change U.S. dollars in Cuba. But they will only do that once they can verify that the United States has stopped fining all the foreign banks that they do business with. You know, the United States tries to prevent Cuba from engaging in ordinary commercial transactions with countries, with other countries. And that's why that when the Cubans say that the blockade is extraterritorial, that means that U.S. law is imposed on third countries that engage in ordinary commercial transactions with Cuba.
Walter, there are a number of demands that have been voiced by people in solidarity with Cuba that Obama could institute immediately. I'll cite a few of them. Allow Cuba to use U.S. dollars in international financial transactions.
That's
allow
correct.
Cuban exports to the United States. Ending all financial penalties to U.S. banks that do business with Cuba. Allow Cubans to buy on terms, on credit, when they purchase stuff from the United States. And the repeal of the Cuban Adjustment Act, which gives Cubans special privileges when they come to the United States, and to end all funding of the USAID projects that are aimed at undermining the Cuban government and regime change policies. And last, of course, as we discussed this, the return of Guantanamo. So those are all things that Obama could, with a stroke of a pen as the executive, do to ease things up. And we certainly hope that that happens.
Well, he released the Cuban Five, and that was a good thing.
Sure.
Amazing.
How many of us expected that they would do that?
Never.
But they did.
Yeah.
And they felt compelled to do so for their own interests, because at the very same time that Washington is taking a softer tone rhetorically toward Cuba, they're taking as tough line as ever.
Oops. Walter?
Yes, good morning.
Oh, okay, here we go again, part two.
Sorry for the technical difficulty. We'll just leave that question.
Walter, tell us about Cuba news.
All right. I've started traveling to Cuba in 1999, and it's a Yahoo News group, and it's been active since August of 2000. It's basically a Yahoo News group. It costs nothing to subscribe. I try to collect material from the Cuban media and from other media and send it out to about 2,000 people who are interested in following events that are information that is from, about, or related to Cuba.
So
you can subscribe by just using phrase Cuba News Yahoo News Group. Go to Google, and it'll probably come up there. And if you have difficulty with that, you can write to me at walterlx@earthlinkwithak.net. That's Walter Lippmann, walterlx@earthlink.net, and I'll send you the invitation.
Excellent.
And I hope you'll enjoy it, and I enjoy having discussion and information. And I don't only present one-sided information. I present other points of view, and if there's people want to have discussion or commentary, that's fine too.
Well, I can tell you, Walter, that I've been a longtime subscriber to Cuba News, and it's a really valuable resource for people who are interested in what's going on in Cuba. Well, Walter, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, and I wanted to ask you if you had any last thought you wanted to leave us with.
Well, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing, and it's to President Obama's credit that he recognized that the policies that Washington has followed for over half a century have failed. I think it's unfortunate that he hasn't recognized the fact that those policy objectives, which failed, were the wrong policies. the United States and Cuba should be friends, should work together, should collaborate on many things where they can and have where they can cooperate, because they do. There is so much history that they have in common. It's unfortunate that the United States still retains the idea that its model of social and political life should be imposed on Cuba and essentially on every other country. That's the problem and that's the challenge. I think what we need to do here in the United States is to do everything that we can to encourage people to do two things. First of all, to travel to Cuba and see it for themselves. That's the number one thing. And secondly, we should do whatever we can to encourage and expand contact between Cuban people and Cubans who wish to come to the United States and work and visit, and also for Cubans to be able to sell their products into the United States so they can earn some money. They can sell goods and services like hotel rooms, but they can't sell their commodities. They can't sell the things that they grow and that they grow and make, from sugar to rum and tobacco and so forth. So we need to encourage as much possible openness in the United States toward Cuba and an end to the U.S. policy of trying to overthrow the Cuban system.
Walter, we couldn't agree with you more. It's been a pleasure to chat with you, and we hope to have you on again.
I'd be delighted. Please call me anytime. I'd be delighted to speak with you. Thanks so kindly.
Thank you,
Walter Lippmann from Cuba News. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Eli, yet another festival is rolling around.
The 8th Annual Brooklyn Folk Festival. It's very exciting. It's coming up on April 8th, 9th, and 10th at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. About 35 different bands, workshops, jam sessions, film screenings, and contests, including the return of our famous banjo toss, banjo throwing competition.
Does that banjo get tossed into the river?
It does, yeah. We have a banjo that we tie to a rope, and we throw it out actually into the Gowanus Canal, which is a federally designated Superfund site, but we do provide rubber gloves.
The poor banjo.
It's used to it. We've been using the same one for years. It's hung in there somehow.
It's called banjo abuse, I think, and there may be a law against it.
It's sad, yeah.
It sounds like a great event. And we urge our listeners to take part in any way that they can.
Oh, it's going to be a wonderful festival. Very large selection of different bands, American folk music that people might be familiar with, blues, old-time string bands, songwriters, as well as music from many communities in New York, representing music from all over the world, Mexico, Ethiopia. We have some Afro-Colombian music this year, Syrian music, traditional music from Syria. And then also a wonderful political activist and singer is coming from her home in Louisville, Kentucky. Maddie Jones is coming to do a large Freedom Songs of the Civil Rights Movement workshop at the festival as well. So she's going to speak a little bit about her life of activism and teach the crowd some of the freedom songs from the civil rights era.
So this is really an educational as well as an enjoyable event.
Oh yeah, it's edutainment. I mean, it's clearly it's fun, it's entertainment. But of course, we try to educate our audience as well. A lot of people might not be very familiar with the musical styles, and also with the artists that we bring. It's a music based festival. I booked the festival based on the music, not on celebrity or hype or anything like that. So if people want to discover some great new artists, they should come down to the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
Eli, is your band, the Downhill Strugglers, going to be playing?
Yeah, sure, of course. I always book my own little string band. The Downhill Strugglers will be playing along with our friend and mentor, John Cohen, from the New Lost City Ramblers. So we'll be there as well, along with about 35 other bands. Tickets are very affordable and reasonably priced, and people can check out the full schedule at brooklynfolkfest.com.
Eli, is this going to be available online anywhere or broadcast?
Yeah, that's right. People can listen to the Brooklyn Folk Festival on the internet. It'll be live streamed, so you can check the Brooklyn Folk Festival website, brooklynfolkfest.com, for details about how, if you can't make it down to the festival or if you want to listen when you're not there, tune in on the internet.
Eli, this is truly a significant cultural event, and we urge all of our listeners to come to this, and congratulations on keeping this not only going for all these years, but really thriving.
Thank you so much. It is a thriving festival. It's grown every year. We're at our largest venue to date, St. Anne's Church, a beautiful sort of Gothic cathedral type of building on Montague and Clinton Street there in Brooklyn Heights, very easy to get to by public transportation. And, once again, the Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 8th, 9th, and 10th, Friday, Saturday, Sunday there. And it's coming up, so get your tickets now.
Eli, you've brought your guitar. Can you play us a tune?
Yeah, sure. Here's one called The Guitar Rag. And, I should mention also at the Brooklyn Folk Festival, there's going to be a real nice topical songs workshop. So if people want to hear some contemporary, modern, quote, protest songs or songs about social issues, this is the WBAI listenership after all. Please check out our topical songs portion at the Brooklyn Folk Festival as well.
Eli will be there in full force.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me back on Law and Disorder.
Our pleasure. Bye-bye.